Robert Parker would like to see the average American reach for a glass of wine with a meal the way they might reach for a Coke. Parker is considered by many to be one of the world's leading wine critics. His newsletter, The Wine Advocate, has the influence to make or break a vineyard. He's also written three books on his favorite subject. Parker says he started writing about wine to help the consumer choose the best buy for the money. That was 10 years ago. Today, Parker tastes nearly 10,000 different wines a year. I asked him what he looks for in a wine.
A wine that smells like a barnyard or smells like a chemical plant is obviously a bad wine and not terribly enjoyable. I think you're looking, it's like whether you're looking at a work of art or listening to music, you're looking for a certain harmony. And when I say harmony, I'm talking about a balanced impression in the mouth. You don't want the wine to taste tart like you're biting into a lemon. You don't want it to taste real acidic. You don't want it to taste astringent, as if someone were rubbing a piece of sandpaper across your tongue. You want to be able to taste something that is velvety and is enjoyable to drink. And if you can't reach that conclusion that's enjoyable, then something's probably wrong with the wine.
I know that there's some days when I just have a kind of funny taste in my mouth that I can't seem to get rid of. For you, that would really be an occupational hazard. What do you do to make sure that your palate is cleared before tasting a wine?
Well, there's no question that if you're going to taste wines, there are certain things that you should avoid. If you've been nibbling on a lot of chocolate bars, chocolate is absolutely, it leaves a residue on your palate that absolutely destroys the taste of both white and red wine. And so, you want to stay away from chocolate. There are other foods. Obviously you wouldn't go to your favorite Cajun restaurant and have a big spicy meal and want to drink a fine wine because wine just don't work with that sort of food. If you'd like to eat a lot of garlic actually doesn't work that well with wine, especially fresh garlic. Vinegar is, of course, one of the taboos if you're going to taste a lot of wine. But I find some of these are overworked. This whole field of wine food matchups has probably been so legislated by the wine press that it actually intimidates people.
How many hours before you taste wine do you brush your teeth?
Oh, well, I get up very early in the morning and I brush my teeth, but I never drink coffee the day that I'm going to be tasting wine. Coffee is another caffeine for me anyhow. I don't know how it affects other people, but for me, leaves a residue and gives the wines a certain sharpness. So I brush my teeth, but one of the things I do and have learned is sort of a trick of the professional wine tasting is I drink an enormous amount of water. And what I find the most refreshing thing for cleaning your palate, so to speak, after you taste 20, 25 wines, there's a certain amount of fatigue that sets in. I will drink, have Perrier or some other sort of sparkling water, and I'll taste that, gargle it, spit it out, and I find this tends to revive the palate.
When you're tasting wine, do you actually swallow it, or do you, like some wine tasters do, swish it around your mouth and then spit it out?
And when you're tasting professionally, you obviously can't, particularly when you're tasting the number of wines that I am, you can't possibly swallow the wine. You'd be
totally inebriated.
By mid-morning,
right.
If not earlier. So, I think you have to spit it out. Some people say, gee, I can't really effectively taste the wine unless I swallow it. That's a myth. All you have to do, your tongue is divided into sort of tasting centers, and which pick up, sharpness, softness, sugar, acid, and the impression of depth. Most of the wine evaluation, to be truthful, is really based on smell. But I spit, and what I do is, I sort of take a sip of wine, and by pulling in air over the wine, the wine, all these aromas from the wine sort of oxidize and evaporate and go up into your nasal passages. And then by circulating it around on your palate and then spitting it out, the most important thing of telling the difference between a good and a great wine is that after you spit it out, or in the case of someone who's drinking, swallowing the wine, is the perception that wine is still in your mouth. Even after there's none there, it's this residue of the wine left on your palate or your tongue. Generally, that's called length or finish. And the great wines, the really outstanding wines, that perception can last 30 seconds, 45 seconds, even 60 seconds. I've even gone to the trouble of sitting watching my watch and saying, gee, can I still sense this wine there?
I'm interested in the language of wine writing. You have to come up with descriptions for every single wine that you taste. I just chose one at random, really. Here's a description of one of the many Bordeaux's in your Bordeaux book. You describe it as a rather loosely knit wine with very good color, jammy, grapey, fruit, low acidity, and a lush, supple texture. This medium to full-bodied wine has a precocious personality and a charming fruitiness and will evolve rapidly. The language of wine is so interesting. It's like you're talking about a person, a precocious personality, a charming fruitiness. Is this like standard language for wine?
Well, I think one of the things that I didn't find attractive when I was reading a lot of wine books is that so much of the language about wine was very stilted, because I think England has long been recognized as the wine writing capital of the world. And the English, you know, used, I think, almost elitist terms and very floral sort of writing style. And what I tried to do when I started writing was really be direct and simple. Now, you may find that description, you know, quite overly complex or something. But, you know, I tried to, one, say, look, wines do have personalities. And I often, you know, you can compare certain wines to, a plump individual or a reticent or shy individual. And I keep it simple. I mean, if I started saying that this wine smells of mahogany or some sort of rare flower like a lot of wine writers have done for centuries, how many people know what that smells like? Even saying a wine smells like a truffle, how many people actually get a chance to taste a fresh truffle or something? I mean, I have used that term because I do sense that in certain wines. But I try and keep it very simple and very straightforward and try and use analogies to behavior characteristics of human beings, because I think wines are living and they're changing and they have personalities and character. And so if you can describe it in that sense, I think it's more meaningful to the reader.
You know, I don't know if you'll agree with this, but it seems to me that in the United States, drinking wine is considered somewhat effete and effeminate. And you know how men are sometimes mocked for liking white wine? I mean, I can't really understand that. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that the general image of wine in the United States, unfortunately, is one of a sort of an elitist beverage. At least the fine wine sector. And I think this is unfortunate. And because to me, it's a beverage for the masses. I mean, you know, you just look at Western Europe, and I think the proof is that, you know, people are literally, wine is part of the meal. It's part of the culture. And I think in this country, we just have so much wine available for sale, and it's probably the most sophisticated marketplace in the world for wine. But I think what happens, the image of wine is that, one, it's you know, you've seen advertisements for wine on television that I think are appalling. You see, you know, a man being driven home in his black limousine by a chauffeur, and he pulls up to this, you know, this multi-million-dollar mansion, and he's met by his butler with a glass of wine. That promotes an image of wine as an elitist beverage. And you go into a restaurant, I mean, one of the things that I think is atrocious in this country is that the great majority of restaurants, you know, treat wine as a special event beverage. You go into the restaurant, you look at the wine list. Generally, it's impossible to get a decent, I'm not talking about a great bottle or a good bottle, I'm talking about a decent bottle of wine that doesn't cost more than your entire meal.
Wine is also an investment for some people, because the expensive wines are rare and can go up in value. Do you think that your wine writing, the books and the newsletters, affect the prices of wine?
Well, I mean,
people who are investors?
I mean, I get accused of having a huge effect on the marketplace and that causing prices to go up when I recommend certain wines. But I think that, I mean, I look at it as a sort of a byproduct of credibility that, you know, if I didn't have, you know, if people didn't believe in what I was writing about, they wouldn't obviously be buying the wines that I'd recommend. But I think it's really just the product of supply and demand. There's little of it left, and so the price goes up. I think I don't believe in wine as an investment. I never have. Certainly people have used my Wine Advocate as an investment tool. But I've never condoned it. I believe that if you're going to buy, you know, the fine Bordeaux and Burgundies and vintage Port, I guess the three types of wines that are often looked at as investment-grade wines, you should be prepared to drink your investment. I mean, I think the thing about buying, let's take, for example, Bordeaux or vintage Port early before it's mature or ready to drink, is that you can buy it at a much lower price. People have looked at this, and certainly they've said, gee, you can invest in wine and you can resell. Certainly in certain countries like the United Kingdom, they have actually tax schemes that have encouraged investment in wine. But I think it's a very dangerous game. And I think people, you can look for every person who's made a lot of money investing in wine. There are probably five or six people who have been stuck with wine that they bought thinking it was a good investment. And now they're faced with the fact of losing money on it or drinking it, and they probably didn't buy it to drink.
Do you invest in wine?
No, never have and never will.
Is there a wine drinking experience that stands out in your mind as just the best you've ever had?
Well, I've had a lot of awfully good ones. I think the only thing I can say about wine drinking experiences, the best one are sharing really good bottles of wine with a lot of friends. I had never known someone who loved wine who wanted to drink it by himself or herself. And I think this is one of the great social benefits of wine drinking that probably gets overlooked. But I think great wine with some of your best friends and with some good food on the table is really, I mean, I can't really ask for anything more in life.
Well, Robert Parker, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been my pleasure.
Robert Parker publishes his newsletter, The Wine Advocate, from his home in Parkton, Maryland. He spoke to us from NPR station WJHU in Baltimore. This is Fresh Air.